All right, good morning. Good morning to all of you. I'm really excited to see so many of you here today. So today's session is a deeper dive into root causes of migration. My name is Mary Campbell. My pronouns are she, her, ella, and I'm the program director of AMPARO, which is the ELCA strategy to accompany migrant minors with protection, advocacy, representation, and opportunities. So today we're doing a deeper dive in why are people fleeing. This is about the root causes of migration. And it's really a pleasure to be joined by our regional representatives for West and Central Africa, Willie and Anne Lange, who are right here in the front. So you're gonna be hearing from them as well. And it's just a happenstance that we're here the same week. This was not something we were able to pull off, but we did. So it's great. So what we're going to do two things today, since we're hopefully going to finish close to 11:30, but sometimes the migrant journey takes a little longer, right? You know, and so if we don't quite finish by then, you'll understand a little bit. And if you have to go somewhere because you have an appointment, don't worry. We won't be offended if you have to jump up and go. So two parts to the experience. First, we're going to do just a little bit of background today on why are people fleeing, and you're going to hear the testimony from Willie and Anne, you know, about what's happening in West Africa, and testimony from our regional representative for AMPARO, Stephen Deal, who's actually lived in the region since 1992. And then we are going to have the experience where we are going to be taking the migrant journey. You can't see Mexico because it's behind the screen right now, but if you're looking over on that wall, you are going to see Cameroon, and over here we have Venezuela and Colombia, and then we have Panama there, and we'll be moving around. And we are going to need some people to take some parts for this today. So, you know, hopefully there are enough actors in this group that will feel that they could do that, because they will be moving around this room. And the rest of you will have the pleasure of being able to stay still. So today is really a propitious day for us to be talking about migration, because do you know that today is the 70th anniversary of the United Nations Convention for Refugees? 70th, and here we are marking this moment. So, and we know how much that has meant for people around the world. And we also know that the last 4 years have been so difficult, you know, where the United States has not been admitting the numbers of refugees that previously were admitted. And so people who were about to get on planes were stopped. And then, because the paperwork is so painstaking, they had to start their paperwork over again. And usually it takes at least 2 years. So it really made a change for so many families who thought they were so close to being able to leave and find permanent lives. You know, people in refugee camps with an average of at least 17 years and sometimes even longer than that. And very few that actually get the opportunity to be accepted to another country and be able to migrate. So today we need to think about that, and we also need to be at least a little bit more excited too about the fact that even though the administration made promises about changing the number of refugees that would be allowed to enter the United States, kind of backtracked a little bit, but the pressure, you know, of the American people to admit more refugees really did make a change. They heard the voices saying, oh no, we're not going back to that number. So the number has been increased. And in the ELCA, we work with Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service. And so they have had to really scale back over the last 4 years. So some of their offices are not even open anymore. And the big nine resettlement agencies in the United States all had to scale back, but now are trying to ramp up again. And in fact, we work in the ELCA with Church World Service as well, and LIRS, and actually the nine work together. You know, this includes the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is involved in this, and this involves Episcopal Migration Ministries as well. They're all trying to make themselves strong enough to be able to accept this number of refugees. Because realistically speaking, 62,500, our nine resettlement agencies do not have the capacity at this moment to actually bring in that many people. But people are coming. So this is the exciting moment. And so we have been hearing from them that there's going to be a new possibility for you to be able, if you are a congregation that is located more than 50 miles away from one of the resettlement agencies. In the past, they always said, no, your congregation cannot be involved in refugee resettlement. That is now changing. And in fact, Church World Service and LIRS have talked with us about where do we have strength in our congregations? Where could they mount another office to be able to serve refugees coming in? And also, where do we have congregations that are kind of in a remote location where they could possibly do it remotely? I mean, now that we have such a higher capacity on Zoom than we ever had before, there is the feeling that this can be done a little bit more remotely instead of the 50-mile limit. So just know that this is available. And if your congregation is interested, you'll have my contact information, and I can, figure out where you can be in touch with the right people, or just be in touch with LIRS or Church World Service, or if you're, Episcopal Migration Ministry, depending on, who you should be in touch with. So that's kind of a little extra commercial, which probably took, a little more time than it should. But we have to think about the refugee piece, too. I mean, because here we have, this actually was the shirt that we used at the youth gathering. When the kids from the ELCA youth gathering went through the migrant or refugee journey last time, which is what they did, and they did in large numbers, they all got one of these shirts at the end. And some of them went through twice and got two shirts. So I'm going to start out just in general a little bit by talking about why are people fleeing. So here we have some figures at a glance. A record number of people are currently forcibly displaced as of the end of 2020. So these are the UN statistics. 82.4 million people are displaced. This is up 60, from 60 million just 5 years ago. So you can see that there are more and more and more people on the move right now. 48 million of them are internally displaced. So the largest number of people end up staying in their countries of origin, okay? 20.7 are refugees with UNHCR, that population I was just talking to you about, that go through that whole process of vetting that the UNHCR, the UN, that's the United Nations, High Commission for Refugees. That's what UNHCR stands for. Okay, 5.7 are Palestinians, and they're broken out. 5.7 million are Palestinians who are working with UNRWA, which I will have to look up again. But Palestinians are counted separately, so it's good to know that number as well. 4.1 million are asylum seekers. For some reason, they've broken out Venezuelans, because I think they haven't figured that, in statistics, the UN hasn't figured out how they count. Are they asylum seekers or are they refugees? Because really, refugees and asylum seekers are basically the same thing. These are people fleeing conflict and persecution. So you have 3.9 million of them separately to the 4.1 million of asylum seekers that I was just telling you about. And here's a really important statistic, 35 million are children. That is a lot of children. So root causes, conflict, disasters, and development. That's what's being named. Yesterday, if you were here, you saw a different list, corruption and violence. These are the UN, the way the UN counts them in statistics. So these are those root causes. And here, according to UNHCR, 68% of the people we're talking about are from five countries. We have 6.8 million from Syria, 4.9 million from Venezuela, 2.8 million from Afghanistan, 2.2 from South Sudan, and 1.1 from Myanmar. Those are the five countries with the largest numbers.
Excuse me, the last slide you said development?
Yes.
What does that mean? Is that just people getting moved out for buildings?
No.
It's like economic or it's poverty. I mean, I guess you could, I don't know. What would you say, Ann and Willie?
It's the poverty-related indicator. Because
development
is the lack of opportunities for education, access to health care, economic activity.
Yeah, yeah. That's how they're counting it, which is, you know, it's and it's that whole argument about underdevelopment, calling, you know, I mean, it's, you know, this is the UN. They use different language than the church would use for talking about people and places. So I told you the 68% from five countries, we named those. Now, five countries host 39% of all the forcibly displaced. Five countries. And which five countries are those? Turkey has 4 million, okay? 92% of them are Syrians. And then you have Colombia. Colombia has 1.7 million Venezuelans. And Colombia actually did some really great legislation recently to protect. They had more people fleeing than people entering before because of the war in Colombia. And now, which is, some people say resolved and others don't, but it was a very long war. And but now they're receiving Venezuelans in huge numbers. So they have camps and they have ways. So they actually had to, their government had to pass an immigration law. They never had to have one before, and now they have to have one. And so they have actually instituted new protections for the Venezuelan refugees that are coming to their country, which is really great. Germany has 1.5 million. 44% of them are Syrians. Pakistan is the last of the five and has 1.4 million. Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not the last. There's one more. And Uganda has 1.4 million. So those are those. So you have the places where people are fleeing from, and then the ones that are hosting the largest numbers. You notice the United States is not listed there. Okay. In the demographics, what you're seeing here on this slide is that most are adults. You see that big blue number in the red number? Because the blues are the males and the reds are the females on that. And the older, the ones up to, 59 years, it's like 18 to 59 are those two big lines there. It's hard to see from where you guys are. And the older ones are above that. And then the ones from 17 to 0 are those three before below that. So what's significant about this is that most of them obviously are adults, but children, even though they only make up 30% of the world's population in numbers, make up 42% of the forcibly displaced. So it means that children make up more of the amounts and the numbers of forcibly displaced, you know, than their percentage in the world should count for. So that's where children are truly suffering as a result of that. Okay. Let's see here. Yeah. Does somebody want to ask a question? No. Okay. All right. So here what we're looking at is 11.2 million people are new displacements in 2020. So that's, you know, even though we were going through the whole COVID thing, 11.2 million were still moving from their homes, even though everybody had to be stationary because they had no choice. But the majority of them were internally displaced people. So if you ever see that little abbreviation IDP, because people always say IDP, who are they? Internally displaced persons. You know, that's who the IDPs are, and they're counted separately. Okay. Here are the major migratory routes. Here, this map shows the top 10 routes. So that's where we start to look at the fact that the Americas are incredibly significant, and that's what we're going to be seeing as we continue in our session today. So as expected, the route to the U.S. is one. And what's really interesting, I will be able to share this for those of you who are interested. There is an article that was done by a really incredible researcher that I trust greatly named Michael Clemens. And he wrote an article called The Real Root Causes of America's Border Crisis and How Biden Can Address Them. Mm-hmm. And it's and he really, he is a fellow at the Center for Global Development, and he's also part of the Institute of Labor Economics. And what he says in this article is that it's not going to, even though Biden has said that there's going to be some focus on doing work with root causes in countries of origin, particularly in Central America, that is a long, obviously a long-term process to do. And it's not going to happen overnight. So what he says is that it is the long-term trend, decade trends, that are actually, you know, if you look at where people are coming from, the long-term trends are caused by prosperity and a large youth population in countries of origin. So what happens is when certain people reach a certain level, so they have the financial resources to migrate, they will. So that's to, uh-oh, a couple of our things just maybe took a little dive, but we'll get them back. And so what you're seeing there is that prosperity means more people will flee, you know, to look for better opportunities. And when there's a large youth population and there are no jobs available, then you're seeing larger numbers of people leaving. So that's one of the things. But short term, he says, short term are the shocks. That's what causes people to leave, and that's what we're looking at. So short term are called heat waves. Some bad rainfall, droughts, natural disasters, outbreaks of violence, which is what's happening in so many countries, and corruption. And those are the short-term pieces that are causing people to flee. So he says, you know, the bottom line here is in order to deal with this, we need predictable legal migration channels, which we do not have, you know, right now in the United States. We need a waiver of worker visa fees, particularly for Central America, because we have Central Americans coming and getting jobs here, but they're not part of the worker visa program, and so because of the fees that are associated, and employers don't do them, and a recruitment system that's organized, which we, you know, so it's the whole labor piece that is something that it needs to be addressed. So I would just commend this. He's done some other research talking about, he actually examined violence in Central American communities, and there's a whole other article that will show you an exact map, which will show you when violence went up in a particular municipality in Central America, within months you would see a larger number of people who had left. And, you know, I mean, they could count by looking at who entered the United States during the Obama administration and say, which community did you come from? And then they looked at the violence rates in that community, and it was just easy to see. So, you know, that's part of it there. Okay, so here on this, you're kind of looking at a bigger picture of different migration maps coming. You can see it comes from the New York Times, the World Economic Forum. And so now we're going to start, and we're going to move to the next piece. This is the end of this piece. And let's hear about what is happening in West Africa, particularly.
Good morning again, Willy Langji. I come from Cameroon. Cameroon is one of the countries in West Africa. And the most recent cause of migration is what we call is conflict, as we saw in the number, the three that were listed by the United Nations. And I have an example of one particular woman, Nicole.
Tell that story. Yeah. We're going to use that later. Right?
Okay. But I shouldn't be telling the story now.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that one too.
Okay. But what?
But you should talk about the causes.
Okay. But some of the causes that make people move in West Africa in general, the economic causes, which was called development, people looking for better opportunities from one country to the other. There's a lot of movement within the countries in Africa. So you can have people going from Senegal to Cameroon, from Cameroon to Senegal, or to Ghana and all that, where they feel that there's a better opportunity for them to have jobs and be able to support their families home. But the other part is a conflict, which is what happens very, that's an abrupt situation. With the economic migration, you can think about it, you can plan, and you can take the necessary steps to follow the right processes, getting a visa and all that to get to the next country. But when there is a conflict, you don't have that time. There are many factors that come in, and those factors have to control you. You are no longer able to control them. So you get up, and you have to take some of the most difficult routes to get to wherever you want to go. And at that point, you're thinking more about your safety as an individual, and also thinking about what will happen to your family that stays home. Because when you start moving, very often it's the individual that is going, it's not the whole family. Because it becomes more expensive and more difficult for the family to move as a group. So you see all of those kinds. And movement too has been generally towards Europe with younger people. As we can see in this, what Mary was saying, the ages between 18 and 59 are those people that move. They feel that they are strong enough. They don't have what they need. They still have a future to plan for. So they take very difficult routes, like going through the Sahara Desert on foot, and they encounter very, very difficult situations as they move.
So what about say a little more about what's going on in Cameroon in terms of why are people fleeing in really larger numbers?
Yeah, now the situation in Cameroon has the most recent situation is that there's an ongoing conflict, and what happened is that, you know, Cameroon has two cultures inherited from the two colonial powers, Britain and France. So one part of Cameroon speaks English and the other French. And the two languages, French and English, are official languages. But then the French part is bigger than the English part, the French-speaking part. It's like the reverse of Canada. And what happens is that since independence, the two cultures have been trying to maintain it themselves, to keep themselves going. But what is happening is that the French, because of their population, have been the ones that are trying to sort of assimilate, using the terms of the current president, trying to assimilate the English speaking part. And what the government did, which finally, one of the many things that they did, which finally sparked the conflict, was that the government continued to send lawyers and teachers who speak mainly French to the English-speaking part of the country. And so it was an intentional way to usurp the English. This irritated the English, the teachers and the lawyers in the English-speaking part, who then came out in a peaceful protest to air their grievances. But then, like any government that tries to impose themselves, they use brutal force, which then led to groups being formed in this English-speaking part to respond to that brutal force of the government. Now, the teachers and the lawyers are caught between two armed groups, the government forces and the local resistant groups, you may use the word resistant, armed groups. The teachers and the lawyers are caught because the armed groups feel that the teachers and the lawyers started a conflict. Now they are fighting, and the teachers and the lawyers want to go back to work. So it became a problem for the teachers, and many of them now were basically tracked down and killed. So you have to find out a way to be safe, and the best way for many people was to get out of Cameroon. So we have the situation of a woman who... Anne is trying to keep that story.
Yeah, okay. We're getting back.
All right. Okay.
Somebody's gonna
suspense, yeah. Let's have some suspense.
Somebody will be that woman, but But you're lucky, Willie's going to be accompanying.
All right.
I want to add a couple things about Cameroon. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so my question is that, so you leave Cameroon and you go to Senegal or you go to Ghana. Now, are the tribes kind of intermixed in those countries? So you go from Cameroon and you come to an area where your tribe may be, or your relatives may be, or are you a stranger in a strange land?
Yeah, so initially he was talking about sort of migration in the past was more between the countries on the continent. That doesn't happen as much anymore. There still is movement, but not so much. If you're fleeing, and I was also going to add, he said, he specified that there are two dominant cultures that were inherited from the colonial powers. But Cameroon has 250 ethnic groups.
250?
Yes, 250 plus ethnic groups. So the cultural richness and diversity is much more, and I just wanted to add that initially. Some of those ethnic groups, of course, the borders between our countries are just, you know, have nothing to do with people groups in general. So yes, you may find people of your ethnic group on the other side of the border, but not as far as Cameroon, not as far as Ghana, not as far as, well, yes, as far as Senegal. There's an ethnic group that extends all the way to Senegal. But so there is some of that. What I would also add is within this, he focused on a conflict that is an internal conflict within Cameroon. But Cameroon would also come pretty quickly below some of those other countries that are hosting refugees. Because even before this conflict started 5 years ago, Cameroon was hosting refugees from Nigeria who were fleeing the violence that was caused mainly by this Boko Haram phenomenon in northern Nigeria. And then also a conflict that has been going on for about 8 years in the Central African Republic, which is the country to the east. So, and there it's really interesting because those are communities that we know better because it's the territory where there's more presence of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Cameroon. And the Evangelical Lutheran Church in the Central African Republic is primarily of one ethnic group, which is found also in Cameroon. So there they've crossed borders and been among their people in a way. And Cameroon has been very welcoming, and it has always been, you know, like a really good example, similar to, you know, how Mary mentioned Uganda hosting just a huge number of people. I mean, proportionate to their population, I think Cameroon has 400,000 refugees for a population of 20 million. So it's not just the actual number, but it's also that proportion. So in the U.S., we just sort of shrink away if anybody's comparing those numbers because we're so shameful, frankly. But so I hope that answers your question, and I sort of wanted to speak to that.
No, that's great.
What else did we forget?
I think you did great, but Will, you wanted to say something.
I think she said.
Okay.
And then we were also going to talk a little bit about the example of Senegal. Do you want us to do that?
Sure.
So Senegal is a country in the far west of it's the westernmost country on the continent. And the atlas is up here in front. So for folks who need to refresh their memories later, you can do that. Senegal is a peaceful country. Relatively, there's an ongoing conflict in the very far south of the country, but that hasn't had a tremendous impact. I hate to say that because I know it's significant for the population in that region, but it's not of international significance, really. But the Senegalese are sort of known as being migrants, and you will find Senegalese in the furthest flung corners of the planet. And especially on the African continent, they've done that for decades and decades. But I would say for about the last two or three decades, they have preferred to go to Europe. And if they move, it's more, as we would imagine, maybe migrant laborers would move. So it's an arduous journey, like Willie was explaining. Oftentimes they're going illegally and they're going across the Sahara, or they're taking boats, they're taking fishing boats up the west coast of the continent to get to the Canary Islands or to get to Morocco and then trying to cross into Europe that way. The Senegalese, typically, it's that same age group of really, you know, that productive age group, 18 to 60 or whatever. They would try to migrate, and it would be for economic opportunities. And they would tend to try to go but not keep their families at home because it's not the same reasons. It's not because of insecurity. It's not because of persecution or fear that they're leaving. So they're more seeking opportunities in another place. So, yeah, Mom.
Senegalese probably would never be classified as refugees or asylum seekers, is that right?
They would in really exceptional cases. So LGBTQ Senegalese would flee and have been able to seek asylum because of persecution, because of who they are. But I don't know that that's ever been possible for those seeking to flee the violence in the Casamance in the southern region. So that's the only... The other one might have been female genital mutilation. There would have been some cases. I know from the Gambia, which is a tiny country that juts into Senegal, I know of cases of women who have been able to get asylum because they were at risk of having to undergo female genital mutilation. So, cutting.
Thank you to both of you. That was fabulous. Okay, now it's time for us to take the migrant journey. So we're doing pretty well. So who wants to be Nicole? Who's going to be Nicole? Okay, you get to be Nicole. You're going to be going over to that corner underneath the exit sign. I'll meet you over there, and you'll have a chance to look at this before you become Nicole.
I hope you can read my writing.
It's pretty good, though. That's pretty good. All right, now we're going to need a couple of Central America. Well, we're going to need a Venezuelan. So who's going to be a Venezuelan here? I need somebody. All right, okay. You're going to be a Venezuelan mother, so you're going over here in the center, and here's your piece. Okay, now I need a Central American youth. Who can I get to be a Central American youth?
John.
There you go.
All right, he's going to be a Central. All right. You're kind of going behind the nativity over there. You're going that way. But you're going to be joined by a Central American mother or father. And who's that going to be? You're not going to be alone over there. It's not your father and mother, though.
Here's one.
All right. Okay, we have you. All right, now. Oh, now I got to raise up the screen and do it really well. Not snap it up. Whoops. There. So nobody mess with this cord now, you know, because now we have revealed Mexico. I tried, but at least it was kind of down, so it wasn't too bad. All right, so now, well, this should be an easy one here. Who wants a real easy? Who wants to be a faith-based shelter director in Mexico? What a nice job! All right, you got it. You got it. So you're coming. You actually can sit down for a while because we're not going to get to you for a little while.
Have a seat.
And I'm also looking for a police officer in Mexico. All right, we gotcha. So you guys are both up here. You can sit down for a while. Come on up. Come on up and sit down. Well, you'll see if he's good or not. He'll let you know. All right. Okay. So now we are, well, you know, and well, Willie's right there, so you're lucky on that one. So we're going to first start. We're first starting over here in Cameroon, now that you know something about Cameroon. And we have Nicole here. And Nicole's going to tell us about herself. You can even read it.
Okay. Well, I'm a teacher, okay? And I'm going into Cameroon?
No, you are Cameroon.
I'm Cameroon.
Yeah, just read it.
Okay.
You can read it there. You can just read it.
Read the whole thing.
Yeah.
Nicole is a teacher in Cameroon, which is an ethnically diverse country with two official languages, English and French. 5 years ago, English-speaking lawyers and teachers protested violently against the government, who continued to send lawyers and teachers who speak only French to work in the English-speaking regions. So that's what you're right. So I'm Cameroon, but I'm going into the English, and I'm speaking French. Okay, the response from the government was brutal. Several peaceful protesters were killed and many arrested. And put in prison with no charges. The protests grew larger and all-out conflict erupted when groups formed to respond to the government's military action with force. As a teacher, Nicole is threatened from both sides from conflict, and her only choice seemed to be to flee, leaving her family with two children and the elder, only 9 years old, behind. Nicole believed the best choice was to go to the United States, a country she thought was the land of freedom and opportunities. After she left, her fiancé didn't understand why she isn't able to provide support for him and the children, so he abandoned them. While worrying about her own situation, she doesn't know what will happen with her kids' future and their security.
So now, how is she going to get? She's decided to go to the United States. She's going to cross the ocean. How's that going to happen? We could ask you, but
Willie, there's another thing.
So is it on?
Did you turn it?
Thanks, Julia.
Yes. Try that.
Yep. Yeah. I think it's working. Just talk. Yeah. Oh, I heard it bounce.
Does it work?
Yeah.
Can you hear now?
No. We'll just switch it.
Well, while we wait for that microphone, we can use this one. So Nicole has, as a teacher, she's been working for some time, so she's made some savings. But then that's not enough for her. And you have to go from Cameroon, which is in West Africa, by boat to Nigeria, which is a neighboring country.
Right. So we're take a step forward. Okay, wait. And now?
Yeah. And then you get a plane ticket from Nigeria to Ecuador.
Okay, so now let's go over there. We're
kind of
over here.
Then she meets other people in Ecuador, and they move across to Colombia.
Okay. Right here.
So now they're going to travel through very challenging situations. She needs more money. She's traveling with people that she doesn't know. They fall in the hands of people traffickers or smugglers. Then they go from Colombia to...
Okay, we'll get to that. Yeah.
So how am I making money on my way? Did you say I'm making money?
No, she runs out of money.
She runs out of money.
So she doesn't. Okay. So Nicole has no money at this
point.
And she can't. She wants to know, can I make some?
Here's some mic.
Yeah, okay. I can imagine. Okay, I can imagine.
Okay. You can imagine.
Okay, all right. So she's here now.
Use the mic.
What country is she
in?
Okay.
She is in Colombia. She made it to Colombia. But now we have a Venezuelan who's in a neighboring country.
I'm a Venezuelan mother. I'm married with two teenage sons. Life has become extremely difficult for our family. in the part of Venezuela where I was born, grew up and started a family. The economic situation has gotten so bad that we can no longer have money to pay for food, even if we only eat vegetables, which is the cheapest food we can buy. My husband and I skip meals so that our sons can eat. Like most growing boys, they eat more, but they also like school. This creates a major dilemma for us. If we buy food so that they can eat, there's no money for school. If we buy what they need to go to school, there's no money for food. It's as simple as that. It got so bad that 6 months ago, my husband left Venezuela and crossed the border into Colombia. Thanks to a relative living in a town on the other side of the border, he is working and sending money back so that I can pull together all the documents that my sons and I will need to join him later. That was our plan when he left, but I'm having second thoughts now. Being separated from my husband for the past 6 months has made me realize how hard it is to be separated from my parents and my sisters. The three of us are triplets. If all four of us immigrate to Colombia, we're a close-knit family and have always lived near each other. I can't bear the thought of leaving my family and my sisters behind. On the other hand, my husband and I want to provide a more dignified life for our sons. I just learned that he will be returning to Venezuela soon. My husband fully expects us to go back to Colombia with him, but I'm not sure. This is the hardest decision that I've ever made. What should I do?
What would you like to do? What would you like to do?
Live in Venezuela with my family, all intact.
Okay.
And safe.
But maybe not safe.
I would like it to be safe and have job. I would like it to be safe and have job opportunities, and no political corruption.
She's got a big list there. So. Yeah. Okay, so you've decided to stay, so you get to sit down. Okay, show them that picture. You can pick up that picture, because that is, there she is with her family, right there. It's a small picture, and it'll be there.
Stay.
Yeah.
Did she stay?
She's decided to stay, so she's staying, okay? But now we're back to Nicole, you know, who is in Colombia. And actually, Betsy, that is a very real case that, and actually she decided to go to Colombia, and so she's now working with the YELCO, which is our companion church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Colombia, and so she and her whole family are. I did decide, but you decided to stay. That's fine, you know. So you can have a seat right there. You're in good shape. For now, and so this is a real case of a woman who they have worked with who did come to Colombia, and so here what you're seeing are the pictures of some of other Venezuelans who have made the migrant journey that they are now working with in Colombia. So this has been a mobilization of the whole society, you know, the churches and the government, you know, in Colombia to work with the Venezuelans that they're seeing.
This one works.
Oh. Okay. All right. So now we're in Colombia. So now the next piece of it is going to be to go from Colombia through that little piece of the Darien, you know, which is part of some of the most dangerous and jungle territory, with no roads. Having been close to the edge of Darien myself, I can say that's true. To try to move, you know, through Colombia, because she didn't stay. She decided that's Nicole's not staying, right?
Yeah.
She's moving. And what happens to her on that part of the journey? What's it like? As we go over there to...
As we go over here she has to go through the jungles, by road, by boat, being smuggled into different countries.
So here's a picture of what the Darien looks like from the air, And these are actually Haitians that are coming through this way, I believe. And the woman actually, you know, can see the mud here that they, of the conditions that they're going, that the group is going through. She has a sprained ankle, and they have to pull her up, you know, through that mud, you know, up this hill. And you can see the exhaustion on their faces, you know, in trying to go through the Darien. There is an article that I will show that I have here that describes this. There's also a video that was done by some reporters from the United States who actually took this journey and filmed part of this journey. So there is a video that's possible to see. So, okay, so now we've made it, you know, through the Darien, and but now we're over to Central America. So come on over here. And here we are in either Guatemala or El Salvador or Honduras, and we have a Central American youth.
I am a 13-year-old youth who lives with my mom in a neighborhood which borders on another gang-controlled neighborhood. These gang members have made several attempts to convince me and my friends to join them. So far, I have resisted, but I've been told that I can't say no if I want to live to see another day. My parents want me to go to the U.S. and live with my older sister in Virginia.
Okay, well, here you can keep that. So what questions might you ask our Central American youth, John? What questions do you want to ask them? Now, I'll open it up for you to ask them some questions if you want to. I know you'll be good at this one.
Do you want to go?
Yes. It's very dangerous living where I do.
Is there a specific place I'm supposed to live, or should I just...
No,
so,
you're good.
Okay, so can I say a place then?
Yeah.
So San Pedro Sula is an extremely dangerous city in Honduras, and fleeing it seems to be the only option. Government corruption is immense, and gangs control much of the region.
Absolutely. What he just said is absolutely 100%. Any other questions for him?
I have one.
Okay.
Is your sister willing to welcome you if you can get to Virginia?
Yes, but like the problem is getting there. It's family is very important, and we value each other highly. But getting to the U.S., being able to seek asylum, they turn people away if they can't prove very specific instances of dangers. Even you can even say that you've been threatened by gangs, and you'll just get deported back. The immigration courts are very ruthless that way.
Okay, another question or no? Oh, so Nicole has a question.
So what's going to happen to your family if you leave?
So,
Will the gangs do something to your family if they find you're not there?
Yeah, that's a very real possibility. And it's also true that if you leave and you get deported back, you're likely to be killed for that because you're seen as somebody who fled the community. So even if you can't, even if I can't get to the U.S., staying in Mexico would be safer than returning back to Honduras.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. Thank you. Now let's hear from our Central American father.
I'm a single parent, the sole support of my three children and aging parents through a small store that I run from my home. Our neighborhood borders on a gang-controlled neighborhood. Gang members are frequently seen on our streets. My oldest son is 12, and these gang members have made several attempts to convince him and his friends to join the gang. One of them recently decided to join. 6 months ago, the gang began to collect quotas from all the businesses in the neighborhood, including mine. This biweekly payment has steadily increased, and at this point, it leaves me with barely enough money to feed my family. I have a brother in the U.S. who wants us to come and will help us start a new life there. I don't see an alternative.
Questions for our Central American father. Okay.
Do you think your parents can make the journey?
I don't really think so.
So they're probably not going to go?
Probably not.
Yeah.
What about, or maybe you're talking about this later, the corruption in the governments that they can't control the gang activity?
Or the government is supporting the gang, or the government is taking money from the gang for protection. Yeah, it's a problem, definitely a problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh. What are the ages of your other children, because you are a single adult, trying to get through?
whatever you want.
9 and 10.
Will your child who's in the gang be able to go with you?
He's not in a gang.
He's right? Not in yet. That's the way we really want to get him out of here, yeah.
Other questions for our Central American father? So you're pretty sure you're going?
I can't see how I can't at least try.
Okay. All right. And Nicole, you're still making the journey as well, right? Okay. So now we're on our way to Mexico. So we're moving over here to the middle of the room. And first, well, you can see we had some maps here. So first we have to go, these are some migrant journey maps that, you know, in Guatemala that are available. So that's where Nicole got one of those, and you were from Honduras.
Yeah,
San Pedro Sula. So when you had to go through that way. She might have gone through a different way. And you're from Honduras too, or would you? You can pick one. And okay, so from Salvador. So these are different migratory routes that are going to be taken through Guatemala. But now then they come here. We're all coming over here. And we can see the river between Guatemala and Mexico. So they are going to be crossing that river. And the big decision that they're all going to have to make, okay, now, is it's going to cost them $1 to cross that river. So, and they... How much money do they still have? You know, okay, so you have no money. So I guess you are going through the water. That's what's happening to you. You can't pay the dollar. You have been on the migrant journey for a while, and you probably can swim, right? And so the question is going to be, are you going to pay the dollar and take the boat and stay dry, or are you just going to swim through it? You know, that'll be your decision. And you have those kids. You got those three kids, and you're a little worried about that.
I do have a little money.
So he's decided to use his money. There is a video that was done by the New York Times, which brought had a group of young men that came to that river, and they made a decision not to use the money because they thought that dollar could be useful for food later. So we're just going through the water. So that's what happens. There is a bridge. Where you can cross, you know, with a passport, but you know we don't have anybody here with a passport, so everybody is going that way. Okay.
So if you're from El Salvador and you had a passport and you walked up, could you cross that bridge into Mexico with a passport?
You would not, unless, I mean, the only people that have that privilege are Guatemalans because of what happened during the war, and some of whom had dual citizenship in Mexico, but no. Central Americans can pass through Central America, but when they come there, no. And that's why we've seen the militarization of that border, United States having asked for the militarization of the southern border of Mexico. So, but they're going to make it through there, but, so, okay. But so we're kind of in the middle here. Here's our police officer right here. You are confronted by the police officer. Come on up, all of you. Here he is. All of you. Dad, you got it? Dad?
You're coming.
The river just fell down, but we don't need it anymore.
Really?
I work for the local police of a town in the Mexico-Guatemala border. I'm not quite sure how I feel about the increase of families and children traveling alone from Central America in the past few years. It breaks my heart, but I have also seen an increase in crime. While migrants are sometimes the victims of crimes, they are also at times the perpetrators, and I feel like they have made the town more unsafe. My pay as a police officer is not enough to feed my family of four, so sometimes I will ask migrants to give me money to let them continue their journey. I'm giving them a break and at the same time making some money to feed my family.
All right, so what questions do you have for our Mexican police officer? You guys are really letting him off the hook here.
If they have no money, what do you do?
Ooh. I mean...
Depends on his ethics, right?
I mean, I'm allowed to give an opinion. Am I?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I would probably just let them pass.
I mean, or what if you liked John's shoes?
Maybe take personal possessions from them, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, things like that. you know, things that I could sell to then, I guess, pay, you know, to provide for my family, I guess. Or just, you know, and if I was in a bad mood, I ended up detaining people, you know.
Or like, sending them back.
Yeah, sending them back, yeah.
Mm. Or your judgment.
Yeah, yeah, it's like I'm a judge, yeah.
What that person would do.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you enjoy having this kind of power over people's
lives? I'm sure that someone in this position might. I mean, I can't. It's hard to give an opinion. but
some days you might enjoy it, but some days you might
depends
hate it.
On, it would depend on my mood.
Have you thought about migrating yourself?
Probably. I'm not. I mean, I feel like a lot of people that live in, you know, kind of bordering, you know, towns where they see a lot of people kind of migrating, they might get, you know, think of ideas of, you know, trying to get a better life, and they might think about it. But I mean, if you already have a stable job, you're in an area that doesn't seem to have as many issues, you might be better off staying.
Mm-hmm. All right. So. What do you want to do with this group here? What do you want? What would you like from them?
Well, I know that the business, the shop owner still has some money, right?
Yeah. So you're getting some money.
So I'll get some money.
Pay him off. Okay.
So you can go by.
All right. You're going by. All right. Willie gets to slip by. You know. Okay. Then. Yeah. So you're paying. He's giving up his watch. All right. And what are you going to get? What do you want to do with these two? I mean, they look a little vulnerable, but.
You know. I see that he has, you know, shoes. He mentioned that. So we'll take the nice shoes.
Yep. So he's barefoot now. No, you don't have to take them. But your shoes are gone. You're gone. Uh-oh. Well, and here she is. What are you going to do? Okay. She says she's got
she
a watch.
She had the watch. So I'll take the watch.
So the watch is gone.
Yeah.
You know. All right. Okay. So that's that. All right. You are in good shape. You can pass it on to her. And you can have a seat. So, yep, so you can see everybody did something here. But he's multiplied. You know, he has one jurisdiction. Do you remember? He just said he was, you know,
There's lots of us at every time, you know. So you're going to be going through these kind of checkpoints. Like, not checkpoints, but I guess, you know, you're going to be running into shakedowns.
Multiple times. So yeah, they just moved a few inches out of that, you know. But they made it to this really beautiful shelter, you know. See that? That's actually a picture of a shelter in southern Mexico that the Jesuits have that, you know, have really good services. Mm. And here we have our shelter director.
I'm the director of a migrant shelter in Tapachula, Mexico. We provide shelter for people making the journey for two nights only. Then they have to move on. I used to just do the office work, but the shelter is so swamped that I have to assist in cases, and often work 12-hour days. This work is emotionally draining since I don't always find out what happened to people that pass through the shelter. Are they dead or alive? I'm committed to this work because my faith calls me to it, and I've been doing it for 25 years.
So first of all, doesn't she deserve a round of applause for the work that she has done? And now what questions do you want to ask her? What do you want to ask her?
How do you enforce the 2 days?
I hide people. I don't really enforce the 2 days. Although I do have friends that live nearby, and sometimes I find places for people in the community elsewhere.
What if you run out of spaces?
Yeah.
I guess I need more friends.
Yeah. Then they're gone. But. They've all taken a shower. They've all been able to sleep for two nights, first time in a bed. And before she kicks them out, she has to kick them out, she's going to give them this tiny little map. She's going to give them this map, which shows some, you know, where they can also go for other shelters, you know, as they make the migrant journey. And this map is waterproof. And if you see this map, and this is a real one, you know, it came from Mexico. You can see this map folds up like this. And so she's going to be handing this out to all of them, you know, before they go. And there's another question in the back. The languages and this map, this one only has Spanish in it. So, and that is a very big issue because now in Mexico, you have a lot of Africans that are passing through and coming to our southern border, you know. So, so lots of language questions here. So that's not so helpful for her. Although she has been traveling in Spanish-speaking countries and knows a couple things now, but she doesn't really have the language facility. We got a couple questions here, one in the back and one in the front. So back first.
So how does your prayer life sustain you in this time?
It means everything to me. It's how I keep myself centered and focused on what the service I'm providing.
Okay, and the front question.
Does the shelter have the means to give a small amount of funds to each one leaving so they can continue?
They can barely feed people. Okay, that's too bad.
Because they have to feed, and especially if she hides them, and you know, she's got more meals she's got to come up with there.
So I can't like give people.
Don't have it.
Food to take on the journey with them?
Whatever you have that's been donated to you,
okay,
you can give to people. Okay, we have two more questions, or three more questions, and then we're going to have to move on because I can see we're actually even a minute over.
Well, I think if I could ask the dad a question.
Ask the dad a question.
Your son was being approached by gangs, but your other two children are daughters. I'm just wondering if there are any special challenges with traveling with young girls.
That's such a, Cindy, what a beautiful question to ask, because had we had a Central American girl on this, the first thing her mother would have done is given her made sure she went to the doctor if they could afford to, so that in case she was raped, she would not become pregnant, you know, to get the shot, you know, and that is an expectation. And so Dad might have done that. Dad, if he had the money with the wherewithal, he might have done that, even though you said your girls are very young still. Yeah, so that's a very good issue. Right, and then we have two questions back here.
So for the director, what do you need most? Money, staffing, space, food? What's your greatest need to make things better?
Oh my gosh.
Everything?
Yeah, really, if you have more space, then you need more food, and you need more staff. You need more of all of it. It would be hard to decide what you want. More money.
Exactly, and we have one more question over there.
Yeah, so, all right, so the Jesuit order runs, so the meager money that you get from the Jesuit order, where does that money come from? Does that come from inside Mexico, or does that come from the United States?
Well, you know, I don't, I could...
Both.
Okay, good. That's a question you need to answer. Yeah,
both, because there is support for those shelters. So we have young adults in Global Mission that are serving in shelters in Mexico City. So here is a testimony from Jenna, and she actually works for the ELCA right now. She is... the support for the director of the unit, Christian Community and Leadership, Jenna Lescott, and she said, "I'm Jenna, I'm 22, and I'm volunteering in Mexico City through the LCA Young Adults and Global Mission Program. I serve a small shelter for migrants with 24 beds. The people who sleep in the shelter are mostly Hondurans and are on their way to the U.S. Recently, some other volunteers and I visited some migrants sleeping without much shelter in a concrete field. A man from my shelter asked a woman there if she was cold. When she nodded, he immediately shucked off his heavy winter jacket and gave it to her, waving off her thanks. Just a few minutes later, I watched another of our migrants run after a mother with a child on her hip to give her his scarf. I thought of Matthew 25. We all know. Verse 40, truly I say to you, whatever you did for the least of these brothers and sisters, you did for me. Here are migrants helping migrants, spending 6 hours in the freezing rain, passing out clothes and backpacks, and salvaging medicine from damp boxes. Not only did they show up, but they gave the shirts off their backs, quite literally and without one single complaint. They talked to fellow Hondurans, played with children, joked with other volunteers. They were generous with their time and their love and didn't expect anything in return. It is beyond humbling to know that, watch someone give the jacket off their back, not knowing whether they will get their next jacket and where it might come from, but giving it all the same. I was ashamed when I realized I couldn't imagine parting with my favorite blue pea coat, particularly when it was freezing outside. Talk about a reality check. Because it's cold. You know, we often, sometimes you don't think about that. So that's from Jenna. And that was in her newsletter, which she did on a regular basis. Okay, so they actually had their sleep, but now they have to make that long journey. And what are they gonna come to next? What's gonna happen to them? Where are they going next? Here they come. Here they come to the wall. Okay. All right, so we're about 7 minutes over time. Yeah, you're good. You're good over there. And so all I can say is the journey continues tomorrow as we do the United States immigration system and their first encounters with Customs and Border Patrol. So thank you for being here today. And we really look forward to possibly seeing some of you tomorrow to see what happens to our colleagues here, you know, who are in our friends who have made this really long journey this far. So have a great day.